Let's do this, the Cult of Hockey podcast, by the faithful and for the faithful. I'm David Staples of the Edmonton Journal, and I'm here today with Bruce McCurdy. Welcome, Bruce.
Hey, David.
How are you doing? Season,
silly season's upon us, eh?
Yes, yeah. Just we'll be spend the whole summer bickering about Milan Lucic, it looks like. And talking about silly trade rumors, which is exactly what we're going to be doing on today's podcast, as well as discussing the new contract for Ryan Strome. Let's start with the Strome thing, because it is the one tangible thing.
It's actual real news.
In the last few days. So he signed a two-year deal for, is it $3.1 million per?
Yeah, that's the average. It's actually $3 million for the first year and $3.2 for the second year. And that's a distinction that's important in that if the Oilers re-qualify him as a restricted free agent in 2 years, they would have to offer him the 3.2. And a similar situation held sway this past time. They had to qualify him at the $3 million he earned last year as opposed to the 2.5 cap hit that was on his old salary because he signed for 2 and 3. In this case, the difference is so small, I don't think it makes a pinch of difference, really. I mean,
what do you think of that amount of money for that quality of player in terms of bang for the buck for the Oilers? I mean, could they have got him for less? Should they have got him? Or what do you think about it, Bruce?
My take is that it's basically the going rate of, I mean, third line centers are, you know, $3 million. I mean, there was comparables to him that seemed pretty reasonable. I mean, one guy that was a decent comparable was Boone Jenner, who was in the identical situation of being a five-year pro, almost same birthday, but he was on the other side of June 30th. So in Jenner's case, he only had 2 restricted years left, and Strome had 3. The Oilers used that to their advantage. But their, you know, their scoring history, their background history was the same, and in Jenner's case, they paid $3.75 million for 4 years. They bought a couple of unrestricted years in there, but basically they paid a premium for those. So now Boone Jenner and Ryan Strome are not the same player or not that similar of players, but the job they do is similar.
I liked Ryan Strome a lot more at the end of the year than I did at the start of the year. The first 3 or 4 months, it was pretty uninspiring watching this guy play. He just seemed a little bit lost out there on the ice. Once he got, essentially he took over Mark Letestu's role, both as the first guy sent out on the PK and on the left flank, left face-off circle on the power play. And he did pretty well, much better than Letestu on the PK. It wasn't even close. And it was a huge reason, I actually think, was the simple replacement of those two players was a huge reason for the improvement in the Oilers' PK work. That was the key move that was made in going from the worst in the league to one of the best PK units in the league. As simple as that. And he did it because he's really smart. He's rangy. He's young enough and fast enough to block those passing lanes. And suddenly the cross seam passes that were killing the Oilers were no longer going through. He was less effective on the power play, but he was okay-ish on the power play. I mean, he didn't do enough there that I would say he's any kind of answer on that first unit. I, of course, really think Jesse Puljujärvi needs to be in that spot. At even strength, Bruce, I like the fact that he was said to have mentored Puljujärvi. That was, you need that kind of culture of players taking each other, a veteran taking a younger player under his wing and helping him out. And he strikes me as a player who lacks confidence, which might sound strange for an NHL player, but doesn't strike me as a really forceful player. I think Nugent Hopkins has been in the same boat where someone needed to encourage him, like, you will carry the puck. You are going to make plays with the puck. Mm-hmm. That's what we expect of you. That's what happened with RNH. And I think I'd love to see a line for 40 games even where Strome, Puljujärvi, and maybe Kajula team up together on a line. And Puljujärvi's the driver on that line, but Strome is also asked to make a lot of plays. And I think that as a third line, they might be able to consistently outplay the third line on the other team.
Yeah, they had, I mean, the third line down the stretch was Strome with Puljujärvi and Lucic. and they couldn't score to save their souls. I thought they were okay as a line, other than that utter inability to finish. All of them were mired in horrible slumps for much of that stretch time. Strome had one little outburst where he scored. I think he had 5 goals in 5 games, and then he had like zeros on either side for weeks. And his scoring, it comes and goes. I think his value increased when they finally sort of settled on him as a 3C. At the beginning part of the year, he was flitting around. He was playing a lot of right wing. He was playing a little bit of center. They didn't really seem to have a spot, and he was having trouble sort of finding a spot. And then around about the mid-season point, where he was basically 3C the rest of the way, I think that solidified things somewhat. I mean, not that you can tell by the Oilers' record that the team got any better, because they really didn't. But I think his play improved. I thought he became a more reliable player down the stretch. And, I mean, he's still a young guy, right? He just turned 25 this week. So he's 25 and 26-year-old seasons. There's no reason not to expect he's going to be a little bit more reliable, a little more consistent. And then at the other end of it, like I said, by the skin of their teeth, the Oilers still have RFA rights on this guy. His birthday is 11 days too late to be 27, which is built into the CBA as unrestricted. And because Garth Snow capped his games played in his first season to, he was on the roster for 38 games, and you need to be on 40 for that to count as an accrued season. So because of that, he has 4 accrued seasons, and he'll only have 6 in 2 more years, not the 7. That's the other kicker for the unrestricted status. So on both fronts, he misses by just a very tiny number. But because of that, the Oilers will hold negotiating rights or trade rights. You know, I mean, we'll see where we are in 2 years. But it was, I think, a little bit of sharp work to get him in under the 2 years to right on the, you know, the 2-year number, and to keep those rights.
So I think that line, you're right, they didn't get a lot done in the tech. Puljujärvi seemed to have lost confidence as the year went on. Strome, I think, played the best of those three. And then Lucic was just in, you know, god-awful slump. What was it, 1 goal in 48 games in the year?
I'm surprised nobody's been talking about Lucic, David. It's just been, you know, just an eerie silence on the Lucic front. Don't you think we should talk about him?
You know, there was silence, Bruce. Things had settled down. It looked like, when you read all the tea leaves of the situation, it looked like both sides they were frustrated with each other, and frustrated, period. And, you know, they explored, I think, together. They were both open. I think it's pretty clear. They were both, whether someone asked or didn't ask for a trade, I think that's immaterial. I don't think it was like that. These are Johansson, Lucic's agent. This is a bright, sensible person. Shirelli is the same thing. And they just realized it might be in both of our interests together to explore, can we trade this player? It's going to be tough. But could that work for the Oilers? Could it work? You know, does that work for Milan? And they're both thinking, yes. But there was an understanding, I think, on Lucic's camp's part that they're not going to move Lucic and swallow this huge poison pill. You know, no team is going to do that. Because there's a hope that this player can rebound,
right,
and have more trade value at the very least, and maybe they'll repair relations and he'll rebound and everything will be okay. So that Shirelli's weighing all that against. So this is how it plays out, and then it becomes and Elliot Friedman, and I'll read the quote because I think it was the thing that actually set the world on fire in terms of this. I think it was always kind of a low level of fire. Until June 11th, when Friedman in 31 Thoughts wrote, "I'd heard rumors he'd asked for a trade, but that was denied. However, it's clear he and the Oilers are working together to gauge interest. It doesn't look like an easy trade to make without taking back a big contract, but the team seems confident there will be a fit." So it sounded like the Oilers maybe had a deal in place. Probably that was just them being confident there was a fit, was maybe them trying to drive the market up, like, or create a market or make it sound like they weren't desperate. But in the end, it became pretty clear that there was not going to be a trade. And that's when Johansson comes out and says, Milan's coming back to Edmonton. He's committed and he's going to give it his all, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's a clear message that whatever bad blood there was, everyone realizes that the only option, the only realistic option at that point is for Lucic to come back and give his all in Edmonton. So I thought it was kind of dead at that point, Bruce. Yeah. Like there was nothing happening. That was my reading of the situation up until then. Any thoughts that you have?
Well, I put some credence in the suggestion that if they waited until July 2nd, paid Lucic the bonus, brought his actual owed salary down to, it would have been 22.5 million left of the 42 million with 5 of the years still to play on it, that he would be, you know, from an asset perspective, it's more justifiable to pay that player 4.5 million. I mean, that's what Calgary was paying Troy Brouwer, for example. I think there's some comparisons there. The issue, of course, is cap hit, and cap hit means different things to different teams. Some teams trying to get to the cap floor, they like contracts where the cap hit is higher than the actual payout because they're on a budget. But when you're trying to get to the cap floor by paying $6 million for an underproductive player, I mean, you haven't got a whole lot else on your team, it would be my read of that. But I think there's a couple places where it might fit, but July 2nd came and went. There was no move, and seemed like the comments of Johansson, who I met Johansson at a analytics convention one time, had a nice chat with him, and now what people say off the record, but he seemed like a very straight shooter, and he wasn't sort of beating around the bush. He was given... he gave a talk about what agents do to represent their players. And I was pretty impressed with him. I don't get the idea that he's a prevaricator that beats around the bush. That said, the agent has to look out for the best interest of their client. And sometimes how you parse your words, for instance, he could say something like, Milan never asked for a trade from the Oilers without saying, well, I asked on his behalf because I'm his agent. And you can word it, but I don't get the sense that that's his thing. But I also don't doubt that there was expiration of, I would think there's expiration of many players every summer. What's out there? What could we get for this guy? Let's find out if there's gauge the market for interest.
I don't think it's important, Bruce, how he answered that question or like what he said. It's just noise. Like who cares what he said? Like I don't expect him to tell the truth, not tell. It doesn't even matter. I think it's pretty clear though, from all the rumors, they were looking for a trade. Both sides were open to a trade. I mean, just Friedman doesn't get things like this wrong. He got it right. This happened. This is the fact. And whatever Johansson says or Chiarelli says, it doesn't matter. It's all just kind of blah, blah, blah. I mean, they don't want to amp at that point when Johansson's asked, did you ask for a trade? He doesn't want to amp. He's trying to sell his client, the Oilers, the fan base, on the idea that Lucic is coming back, because that's the reality at that point. Chiarelli's been trying to make a trade for a couple weeks for July 1st, as you say. Nothing's in place. Nothing's going to happen. So they've all got to move on to plan B, and they've got to be – plan B is not going to work if people aren't committed to it. Right. If Lucic himself isn't committed to making it work in Edmonton, if the Oilers aren't. So everyone's got to start buying in and sending out that message like, we're in this together. We're going to make this happen. So I was really impressed, actually, with what Johansson said. And it doesn't matter to me whether he pulled a white lie or a fib. I have no idea. Like, it doesn't – and it's – everyone's hung up on that. I just think it's not – like, don't get hung up on that. What's important there was his message that Lucic is coming back.
Right.
Because that was the reality at that point. They needed everyone to buy in on it. So then the interesting thing – I thought it was dead. You thought it was dead. And then Frank Saravalli talked to Alan Mitchell, low tide, I think it was on Friday, and it blew up again. Because what Frank portrayed was kind of this dire situation, it seemed to me. And I mean, he compared the Lucic situation in Edmonton to the Erik Karlsson situation in Ottawa, and to Jeff Skinner and Justin Falk in Carolina. And he said, I don't think Milan Lucic is in all that different a category when you consider what he's gone through. And really the position the Oilers are in, it's almost untenable. Saravalli then went on to say that, the Oilers need to do whatever it takes essentially to move this player, just like they moved Hall and Eberle. And have I missed out on any of the other big points that he raised? That's essentially it. So I thought, wow, like comparing this Lucic situation to Erik Karlsson's situation, like I could see comparing it to Skinner or Falk. You know, these are, you know, these are players that are on the block. This was kind of widely rumored, but Karlsson is this uniquely weird and horrendous situation where, you know, there's this horrible situation with his wife and another player's wife. There's this bad blood with the owner, the player. I think he's asked for a trade, right? That's public, is it not, at this point? He's not coming back. Like it's this catastrophic blow up. So I thought, Frank, I thought he just made an overstatement there. It's kind of like a rhetorical flourish or a it was an inexact comparison. And then he would, there was this urgency. Owner's got to make a trade. Owner's got to, this is almost untenable. I just don't see, I just thought that was all these things were overstatements. Now, maybe there's some information I'm not aware of, but that's how I saw it. What was your take, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, his bottom line after mentioning, and I would say the Skinner and Falk comparisons might be a little bit more apt than Erik Karlsson, but he named all four of those, and he says, I don't think Lucic is in all that different of a category when you consider what he's gone through, and really the position the Oilers are in, it's almost untenable. Now, really, what has he gone through compared to what Erik Karlsson went through last year, which, you know, among other things, included a stillborn child and some vicious verbal attacks by either a teammate's girlfriend or somebody pretending to be that. Obviously, I mean, that was just a savagely unfortunate situation, no matter how you slice it. And then you've got the owner in Ottawa with his BS, and like, I don't see there's any comparison. I mean, those two situations to me are about as comparable as comparing Erik Karlsson to Milan Lucic as a player. Like, they're as opposite as can be, almost, right? And in one case, it's underperformance by the player that sparked the problem. In the other, I mean, nobody's going to accuse Erik Karlsson of underperformance. I mean, everybody wants him on their team, right? And I'm not seeing a big, long list of people saying, we need Milan Lucic to fill out our team. So the comparisons are poorly thought through. And that said, having been on the radio and podcast myself a few times, I know sometimes by the time you get to the end of a spiel, you're not necessarily even agreeing with what you were saying at the beginning of it. It's easy to sort of step out and say the wrong word, like untenable in this case. I don't think it's untenable. I think it's difficult and unfortunate. Frankly, David, the thing that concerns me the most out of all this is the suggestions, and we don't, again, have full confirmation that the Lucic family was feeling such pressure from the criticism here in Edmonton that they might want to get out from under it. And that's unfortunately something we've heard too often. I think sometimes we need to amp down the volume a little bit on some of this stuff.
Well, as Stauffer's talked about Lucic being this huge and very knowledgeable sports fan himself, like someone who can talk at length and intelligently in an informed way about all kinds of sports. And I think, you know, that's someone's nature. That's who you are, right? So, but I think to survive in the Edmonton market, I think media training just should be like, you never look at Twitter. You never read The Cult of Hockey. You never read Low Tide. You never read Copper and Blue. You never read the Edmonton Journal. You don't listen to Oilers Now. Don't do any of those things ever. Just completely stay away. You're still going to hear about it enough. But you don't need to. Now, maybe they do that. But it sounds like Lucic might be the kind of person who's on the internet and reading our stuff, which I just think, like, just by its very nature, fan talk is too negative. We're just talking like fans about the team. We say what we think. Often it's negative, and that's really unhealthy. And for players to digest is all of the negativity that comes as a normal course of fan intercourse. And they should stay away from it. I think everyone should stay away from, if you're a public person, there's all this negativity on the internet about you. You should pay attention when smart people start or informed people start telling you stuff, but just the general negativity, what good is it? So I would, you know, I agree, Bruce. It's a little upsetting that maybe, you know, Friedman mentioned that I think the wife, something about the wife not fitting in here, or I'm paraphrasing. I can't remember exactly what it was. I'll go look exactly what it was so I get it right here, because that's important to get it right.
The issue being that even if the player himself does everything you says and ignores the internet and so on, family members are going to be looking for coverage of their favorite person, and they're apt to respond to it. I find actually one of the more interesting follows on Twitter, speaking of family members, is Patrick Maroon's brother, Phil, who is just at the right distance from Patrick that, you know, he's his own man and expresses his own opinion, but obviously he's in Patrick's corner. And there's some pretty interesting exchanges that go on there, a little bit more in the public eye, whereas sometimes you think, the spouses and so on, some of what they get is pretty darn unfair. I remember, James Reimer's wife, the Toronto goalie, and then some of the crap that she had to put up with. And there are some situations where you just shake your head. I mean, obviously Melinda Carlson being another.
Here's the exact quote from Friedman. It was on the radio in Vancouver, June 14th. I think that's another situation where the wife has seen how much heat the player has taken, I think, and isn't always comfortable with that. Right. So that's the exact quote. Yeah, like I think everyone, you come to these markets, like this is why I hate it when on Twitter, like when players, when people making criticisms of the players and they actually at the player, like they put the player. I just think that behavior is reprehensible, honestly. Like you really need to direct the player to your stupid opinion. Like even if it's maybe even you're right. So maybe the player made some terrible plays last night. You think the player doesn't know that? The coach hasn't told him that? And what you're saying, you're venting at the player, right at them, trying to get their attention, is going to help things in any way?
Or picking him off when he leaves a restaurant that he's not winning enough games. I mean, I shouldn't laugh because that was actually disgraceful. But, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah, I just think, like, I don't see the players in public. I just think just leave them alone. Let them be. It is a fishbowl here. So fans of the team, especially the hardcore fans, should be realized that. And don't add to it yourself in terms of adding players online or, you know, I guess if you absolutely have to ask for that autograph, that's okay. Like it's if you're a kid, not if you're an adult though. Just if you're an adult, like do you really need that little piece of paper with another adult's name on it in your house? So just adults back away. Let there's enough pressure on these guys. Don't put any more yourself. Now people could say, oh, this is rich coming from you because you guys are writing constantly and talking constantly about them. But and fair enough. But the fact is, if you and I weren't doing this, like it doesn't decrease the noise. Like this, the reality of making $6 million a year is you're making it because people are fanatically interested in you. So this does and will come with that territory. There is no way around that. That is the reality. So you have to live with the reality, and we all do. And so for them, they've got to not engage. And for the rest of us, we got to back off where it makes sense to do so.
Yeah, no argument on that front.
So let's finish off, Bruce. The Oilers are still apparently maybe possibly looking for a 14th forward, 13th forward on a, probably looks like on a PTO at this point. Tyler Ennis signed in Toronto and Anthony Duclair signed in Columbus. Those were the two players I thought, Bruce, that made the most sense, because you can find a lot of players who are going to fit on your third and fourth lines. Those were the two players who had any hope, I thought, of maybe filling in. It's, you know, they were kind of the same kind of bet that maybe Ty Ratty represented, someone who might possibly step up and be on your first or second line. So they missed out on those two guys, or they weren't interested, or we don't know what happened. I would have been happy with either of those.
Both signed for the league minimum. That was a real shocker. I thought, you know, those guys are coming around at least around $1 million kind of thing. Nope, $650,000, like bottom of the barrel salary. I think one-way deals, but that's no risk for the team, really, by signing them.
What do you think? Should the Oilers just go for PTOs at this point? That's kind of where I'm. I mean, Nick Shore is a young, he's 25. He's a center. I think he's right shot, if I'm not mistaken. And he might be a sensible guy, but there's no one that really screams out.
Yeah, he's a real depth player, however you would slice it. A decent one. I think he'd be a good bet, but only as a, you know, as you say, 14th, 13th forward. Who could, you know, moving up the lineup for a guy like that means moving into the lineup and playing on the fourth line.
What about Benoit Pouliot, Bruce? And I bring him up somewhat mischievously to make a point, actually.
No. Got
a lot of criticism for the Eberle trade last year.
Uh-huh.
In retrospect, maybe his biggest blunder. Because you can argue this, the Strom thing might actually work out for the Oilers in the long run. And, you know, maybe this... You know, maybe Eberle wasn't the right fit, or but the Pouliot thing. They have his cap hit at one point. I think it's 1.3 million for the next 3 years, Bruce, and that is absolutely brutal. It could be the difference between re-upping Darnell Nurse on a long-term deal or not. If they had just kept Pouliot for one more year, he would have probably helped them last year. Apparently, he's a good guy. Everyone liked him. There wasn't that issue going on. Maybe the coach didn't want him on the team anymore, but. If they just kept him, they would maybe have that extra million and $1.3 million to give to Nurse right now, so they could sign him for a $4.7 million long-term contract as opposed to a bridge deal. Because I really think a long-term deal will pay off in Nurse's case, but they don't have the money to do it. And that mistake by Chiarelli, I think it's fair to say a mistake, could be the most telling one that was made last year in terms of handling the players' contracts.
Well, I mean, the mistake, of course, originally was signing him. It turns out the 5-year, $4 million price tag, where both term and cap hit were very much high water marks for this player who'd shunted about from team to team throughout his career. I thought that if the buyout was going to happen, they could have waited one more year, because they did have cap room last year. They didn't come close to the ceiling. And if they'd kept him and played him last year, A, the penalty kill probably would have been better. He would still have today 1 year to run at $4 million. So that would
be obstructing
the Nurse contract. But if they bought him out this year, they would only have 2 years at this 1.333 instead of 4 years. It extends right through to 2021 that they're still going to be paying this guy out. So it's kind of added an extra year on the other end, which is right in the window where you hope to be a contender. So I just thought he did it 1 year too early. I could see it happening with 1 year to run on the contract. But as it turned out, you know, they're going to be eating that cap hit for 3 more years beyond now.
My mistake. I thought it just had 1 more year to run. 2 years to run. Yeah. Like they could have done it. And the point that you make is well taken, Bruce, that the mistake was giving Pouliot that contract in the first place. I mean, a player who had never had a long history with any team had bounced around and, you know, yeah, that was a bad weekend for the Oilers. I think they signed Mark Fain at the same time.
Fain for four at 3.675 and Pouliot at 5x4. They both looked like solid players that would help, you know, beef up the lineup. But both contracts, frankly, turned out to be disasters. There's, you know, whether you want to blame the team, the management, the player himself, or whatever, both deals just... the Oilers paid big money for these two guys and got very little to show for.
Yeah. So, Bruce, the good news about this free agency period was, as we've already talked about, is they had no money to give out other horrible contracts for the future. As you know what? I think about 70-75% of the contracts handed out in this free agency period, especially the ones that had more than term, like more than 1 year, were terrible contracts, and the teams will deeply regret them. Maybe not this year, but within a year or two.
Yeah, there's other Benoit Pouliots and Mark Fains on the market every year, and somebody signs them, and inevitably some wind up being regrettable, and even buyout situations. Yeah, it's that July 1st period, boy, that a double-edged sword. You think you got, you're getting that one player you need to put you over the top or what have you, and then you wind up, you know, 2 years later going, how do we get rid of this boat anchor? We talked about one in particular for much of this podcast.
Bruce, so we're starting the podcast, or we're starting the Cult of Hockey's prospect series tomorrow. The pressure's on you now to come up with that first post. And I'm sure you'll meet that pressure. But so what we've done is Kurt, myself, and we had a couple guest raters this time vote on the Cult of Hockey prospect rating. So we rated all the prospects 1 to 38, I think. There was 38 in the end. And Sean Patrick Ryan of the Oil Knight was invited on. He's got a real expertise on prospects. That's why he was invited in. He watches all kinds of junior hockey games in Ontario and really keeps
he's in London, is he not? Is that not why he's not the, is that why he's the Knight? It's because he's in London?
Correct. I never thought of that, but that's got to be it. And you had also suggested someone, and we invited Matt in, right? Matt from, is it Oiler Prospects? And he participated. So thanks to Sean and Matt. And so Kurt and yourself and I also voted, and we've come to a consensus view on the rankings for what.
Edmonton Prospect Watch, I think, is his Twitter handle. That's a great follow for anyone who is interested in specifically Oiler prospects, because that's 100% what he focuses on. And he's got good info, good video, good intel. So I think with these two additional voters that our rankings, the order of our rankings is probably a little bit more more solid. And ultimately, of course, order of rankings is, it's just guesswork and projection. I mean, number one, I think, is probably pretty obvious. And every year, it's been pretty obvious. I think every year that we've done this since I started doing it in 2011, the number one prospect has been the guy the Oilers just drafted in the first round.
And the reason that that guy is in the
NHL, so he's already off the list of prospects because they've already given him over 25 games, which, by the way, is our cutoff point. If a player has... is eligible for the Calder Trophy, we consider him a prospect. And if he's burned through those requirements, he's either had a season of 25 games or he's gone beyond age 26, then he's no longer considered a prospect. So Mikko Koskinen, for example, he's not a prospect because he's 30 years old.
Indeed. Well, Bruce, let's leave it there. Thanks for talking today.
Yeah, thanks for listening, everyone.
And in the meantime, and in between times, this has been another edition of the Cult of Hockey podcast.